Okay.
There we go. Right, I think that's. There we go. Sorry, I had some technical difficulties, folks, but we're going to be with you as soon as I get this window resized. She doesn't want to do. Let me see here. Maybe I can move this. That up and then move this up. This is going to be better. 2 seconds. There we go. That's more like it. All right. Okay. So, okay, we got closed captioning going on. Okay, I think we're ready. So welcome to this 76th webinar on the Secret Doctrine. Friend of mine sent me this, I think, an amazing professionally colorized photo of HPB, so lifelike. I was really taken by it. Hang on just a sec. A real professional job. It's not easy to do flesh tones on a black and white photo, but I thought this was really brilliantly done. Anyway, this webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheading Moray Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress. All episodes of this, the Secret Teachings of All Ages, the Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and are available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can also access any of these webinars on the homepage of moriafederation.com. Okay, this month in Old Diary Leaves, Colonel Olcott receives the first draft of the Secret Doctrine, finally, after all these years, as he is preparing for the first Theosophical Convention in Adyar, India, shown here. We just make out Olcott and HPB in the crowd there, in this group photo taken in honor of the convention. So you can see him up here. Can we get a reader for this, please?
I'll start you off.
Great.
By the first week of December 1886, Sanskrit poems for the library opening had been received from Benares, Bengal, Bombay, and Madras Pandits, and Sanskrit and Pali verses from the most learned Buddhist priests of Ceylon. About the same time I received from HPB for reading and revision by T. Subba Rao and myself, the MS, a
Manuscript.
volume, okay, the manuscript of volume one of the Secret Doctrine. But in his then captious mood, the former refused to do more than read it, saying that it was so full of mistakes that if he touched it, he should have to rewrite it altogether.
Okay, and you can see on this second part of this just what this first edition look like. You can imagine trying to read this. Could we get a reader for this, please? It's not
Yvonne?
even an edition. It was just a manuscript that she loved to copy, literally cut strips and paste over to edit. That was how she did it. Yeah, reader, please.
Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
Okay, I wasn't able to unmute myself.
Yeah, I fixed it. I fixed it.
Thank you. This was Mayor Peek, but did good. For when I reported his remark to HPB, she was greatly distressed and set to work and went over the manuscript most carefully, correcting many errors due to slipshod literary methods, and with the help of European friends, making the book what it is now. It must be said of her that she was always most eager to have mistakes pointed out and most ready to correct them. Especially was that the case with such of her writings as were not dictated to her psychically by the unseen helpers who presided over the production of her two great books, Isis and the Secret Doctrine, which will be the Jachin and Boaz of her perpetual monument, a wonder to coming generations.
Thank you, Yvonne. I tried to find out where in the Secret Doctrine this was. So I did word searches for all these little bits and pieces that you see, but I couldn't find it. So somewhere, some version of what you see on this page ended up in the final edition. Okay, well, last month we continued with verse 5, where we learned that in order to move into the higher spiritual realms, shown in first generation theosophy in this way, all jivas must first pass through the human kingdom, wherein the pilgrim eventually gains full self-consciousness, again, according to HPB theosophy, made through a progression of egos, beginning with the elemental and ending with the divine ego. So unlike DK theosophy, ego had a very general meaning. It didn't have the specific meaning of the soul aspect as it does in DK. But it just meant a matrix or a center of life force. Okay, we then considered the nature of pure spirit or beingness, which HPB tells us has no relation to the plane on which our universe is accomplishing its cycle, meaning that it is not in any way limited by cyclic manifestation, and for that matter, by any form. It is the pure life aspect exists totally in its full expression at all times, and the spark of that, or the drop in the ocean, as it's sometimes described, stands at the center of all sentient life. We then took a look at a unique definition of karma, which HPB describes as coming into play when a person impedes the natural flow, or what she calls the, quote, legitimate progress of the laws of nature. This impeding, with its resulting karma, is the so-called curse from the second paragraph of this verse. We then took a look at a passage on the great wars in heaven, reference to which is found in all the ancient cultures, and which esoterically refers to that group of asuras, which means formless ones, that refuse to create. Quote, at the inception of the divine plan, there took place the original war in the heavens, when the sons of God, who responded to the divine urge to experience, to serve, and to sacrifice, separated themselves from the sons of God, who responded to no such inspiration, but who chose to stay in their original and high state of being. And this is from DK's externalization of the hierarchy. Yeah, and this takes us up to where we left off last time. HPB continues this theme of the fall into matter. Could we get a reader, please?
Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
Satan and his rebellious host would thus prove, when the meaning of the allegory is explained, to have refused to create physical man, only to become the direct saviors and the creators of divine man. The symbolical teaching is more than mystical and religious. It is purely scientific, as will be seen later on. For instead of remaining a mere blind, functioning medium, impelled and guided by fathomless law, the rebellious angel claimed and enforced his right of independent judgment and will, his right of free agency and responsibility, since man and angel are alike under karmic law.
Thank you, Vivian. So first, Satan and his rebellious host would thus prove, when the meaning of the allegory is explained, to have refused to create physical man only to become the direct saviors and the creators of divine man. Okay, little clarification here. Whereas DK associates the name Satan with the principle of evil and the lunar lords, HPP identifies Satan with the chief Asura, or formless one, who refused to incarnate. For example, thus Satan, once he ceased to be viewed in the superstitious, dogmatic, and philosophical spirit of the churches, grows into the grandiose image of one who made of terrestrial a divine man, who gave him, throughout the long cycle of Mahakalpa, the law of the spirit of life, and made him free from the sin of ignorance, hence of death. So it seems, in reading the passages from DK and from HPB on Satan, it seemed to me that the difference between them is mainly semantical. I think actually DK chose to describe the forces of evil as satanic without delving into the philosophy of the Asuras. That was my take on it. Because if we substitute HPB's use of the name Satan with the name Lucifer, DK system and HPB system become realigned, as we'll find out in this short quote. Could we get a reader, please?
Okay. Magda, I'm going to ask you to read, but first she's got a comment here that says, are we talking about the first or second fall?
Well, that's a good question. There are some aspects of the description of the fall that apply to both, but then there are specifics that apply just to the second fall, that is the quote unquote fallen angels into their role as Manasaputras overshadowing human consciousness.
Okay. Their prince.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Their prince is called in the Kabbalah Samael, the angel of death, who is also seduced serpent Satan, but that Satan is also Lucifer, the bright angel of light, the light and life bringer, the soul alienated from the Holy One, the other angels, and for a period anticipating the time when they would have descended on earth to incarnate in their turn.
Thank you. Nonetheless, the question might be asked, how did those who refused to create become, quote, the direct saviors and the creators of divine man? Two passages from the second volume of The Secret Doctrine give further insight into this. Could we get a reader, please?
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
You always, when you ask Scott, you always act like you're begging.
Yeah. Actually, I was trying to walk and chew bubble gum at the same time, and I don't do that well. I had to
Okay.
unmute, ask him to unmute.
I gotcha.
Okay. I'm here anyway.
Okay.
Those who were born within the sphere of operation were, quote, the brothers who loved him well, unquote. The latter, the him, were the primordial angels, the Asuras, the Ahriman, the Elohim, or sons of God, of whom Satan was one. All those spiritual beings who were called the angels of darkness, because that darkness is absolute light. A fact now neglected, if not entirely forgotten, in theology. Nevertheless, the spirituality of those much abused sons of light, which is darkness, must be evidently as great in comparison with that of the angels next in order, as the ethereality of the latter would be when contrasted with the density of the human body. The former are the firstborn, therefore so near to the confines of pure quiescent spirit as to be the ideal types of those who followed. They could not create material corporeal things, and therefore were said to, in process of time, to have refused to create as commanded by God.
Thank you, Scott. So any questions about this? The reading continues, but this is pretty much the theme of today's entire webinar, this reversal by the church of Satan and the creator gods, where that which was much lesser, in this case Jehovah, was actually made the one God, and that which was much greater. And you know, it's quite difficult, you know, after a lifetime of thinking otherwise, you know, that these Asuric beings, of which Satan, we're here told, is one, are in fact the much greater beings. It's something to that takes some getting used to in terms of psychically. Any other questions about this? This is going to be our theme today. So let's continue with this reading.
Martha, let me ask you to... Martha, can you read for us, please?
Yes, I can. Thank you. Just get this... I'm having trouble finding that. Is the first sentence the Zonar speaks of black?
Zohar.
Say it again, Francis.
Zohar.
Zohar. I only read the half of that. Okay. A black fire, which is absolute light, wisdom. To those who, prompted by old theological prejudice, may say, but the Asuras are the rebel devas, the opponents of the God, hence devils and the spirits of evil. It is answered, esoteric philosophy admits neither good nor evil per se as existing independently in nature. The cause for both is found as regards the cosmos, in the necessity of contraries or contrasts, and with respect to man in his human nature, his ignorance and passions. There is no devil or the utterly depraved, as there are no angels absolutely perfect. There may be spirits of light and of darkness. Thus, Lucifer, the spirit of intellectual enlightenment and freedom of thought, is metaphorically the guiding beacon, which helps man to find his way through the rocks and sandbanks of life. For Lucifer is the Logos in his highest, and the other adversary in his lowest aspect. Again, I keep getting these black things that come up. Sorry, Francis. Okay, here we go. both of which are reflected in our ego. Secret Doctrine 2, page 162.
Yeah, so it's both of these are from the second volume of the Secret Doctrine, both these quotes. Okay, any thoughts or questions about this idea? Well, you'll have plenty of opportunity to consider these concepts as we move along, because it's the theme for much of her next many pages. Okay, next, the symbolical teaching is more than mystical and religious. It is purely scientific, as will be seen later on. For instead of remaining a mere blind, functioning medium, impelled and guided by fathomless law, the rebellious angel claimed and enforced his right of independent judgment and will, his right of free agency and responsibility, since man and angel are alike under karmic law. So the fathomless law, initiated by the logoic will to be, is the invisible force behind all involutionary cycles that compels the lesser classes of building devas to construct the lower she's of humankind, as it should. But the higher class of asuras, or formless dhyanis, among which HPB includes Satan and Lucifer, resisted this law because they were, in the exoteric teaching, unwilling to imprison themselves in form, but in the esoteric teaching, refused in order to, quote, become the direct saviors and creators of divine man. Divine man is the monad, expressing itself through the triad. Thus, the asuras, not suras, formless, called here the rebellious angels, whose darkness is the source of spiritual light, not its absence, are so highly evolved that their self-awareness enabled them to defy the impelling involutional energetic flow inherent in the fathomless law that would otherwise have compelled them to enter the lower regions. But they resisted this law in order that they might build on monadic and triadal levels, in the same way that the devas who followed the law built on monastic, astral, and physical levels. It was considered to be an act of rebellion, metaphorically, because the dominant law of the evolutionary cycle compels all beings to descend onto lower levels, because it's a form-based period of the cycle. But it seems to me that this rebellion has to be metaphorical, because the creation of the higher principles had to be part of the divine plan. In fact, I would think it would be the key part of the divine plan, making the quote-unquote war in heaven foreordained. The term war in heaven also represents a clash between the Titans and the gods, and thus between Saturn and Jupiter, which is an allegory for the transition from the laws governing the previous Ray 3 solar system, hence Saturn, to those governing the current Ray 2 system, hence Jupiter. Any thoughts or questions about these ideas? It's always more interesting when we have a discussion than a lecture.
Mega says, can we connect this wide subject, Return of the Prodigal Son, with DK talking harshly about red hats?
About what?
Red hats.
Oh, the red hats. I'm not familiar enough with the red hats. That's a Tibetan sect, isn't it? but I'm not versed enough in their practice to interesting. He He speaks harshly of this group, huh? That's interesting.
Do you want to clarify, Magda?
Yes, I'm trying to follow this discussion about the fallen angels,
Ooh, you're fading out.
Atlantis. So I was. Excuse me.
Can
you hear me?
You broke up for a little bit. I couldn't hear you.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, tonight I have a little problem with my Bluetooth. Anyway, I was studying about the fallen angels on Lemuria and on Atlantis. And I kind of got to the fact that between the third and the fourth subrace of Lemuria and on Atlantis, in both cases, kind of these fallen angels, all these, so to say, troubles started up in the, you know, midway through the third and fourth subrace. From that, I got to a page of Master DK, which I don't have now with me, but I will try to find it out because I'm sure I took a picture. He was talking about, you know, the only time, you know, how can we put together in theosophy the fact that we're, you know, it's all love, we're all connected, and it's all, you know, with all the good propositions of theosophy and spiritual sciences, how can we put together those sentences of Master DK saying that evil has kind of not, I don't remember the literal words, but was like, did not do good, okay? We're speaking like, I was surprised, and then I found out there was a kind of debate in theosophy about this subject. And so since we are talking tonight, all night, as I understand, about the fallen angels and what exoteric we kind of thought about the subject and what we are apprehending with you esoterically, then I'm trying to kind of put it all together and kind of curious to bring things together that have absolutely nothing to do with each other or not, or the opposite.
I lost the key sentence there at the end because your Bluetooth cut out in it, but I was with you right to the last.
My God, sorry.
What was okay. The result? You're putting it together to dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, exactly. Putting together this fallen angels subject with, for instance, also I was studying the Thevatat, Devadatta, Thevetat, in the Toltecan subrace of the Atlantic globe. So I'm trying to piece all this together. What they say, what I read about Thevatat, be the adversary of the Buddha, and, you know, on the rear, on the dense plane, it was a real, you know, it was during the Toltec, he describes the context in which this battle between the Buddha and his adversary developed on this physical plane. But then studying esoteric, try to connect it with this Thevatat, Devadatta, and that's.
Oh, you're breaking out again.
I was trying to.
You're now gone.
Atlantis, the Kusha, the Toltecan. I'm sorry, I cannot make it. Hello. Yeah.
You were mostly there, but then it'll cut out and make you really difficult to understand
next
the
time.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It appreciate your thoughts. One thing I can say is that, you know, DK isn't universally accepting of people's pathways forward. For instance, he's has critical words about Mahatma Gandhi, you know, who we tend to think of only in terms of, you know, the that whole idea of nonviolent resistance is so important as an idea, but he was saying that to use that in the face of the Axis powers was not appropriate, you know. So, and that, you know, he makes other comments like that about certain groups at certain times who are actually working against the. Another one is the pacifists during World War II. He was saying that there was no place for the pacifist approach during that time, even though pacifism in general represents, you know, the philosophy that is shared by most theosophists. There are times when force must be met with force. And so, you know, unfortunately, you cut out at some critical times, and I'm not able to. And I don't know about the red hats that you mentioned. This must be a Tibetan group, I'm thinking, but I'll have to look that up and see what's referenced by that. But does he mention them by name, red hats?
Well, I could not find a reference to that when I searched the AAB books.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Because I usually something like that would stick in my memory, but I don't remember that. Maybe they're called by another name. At any rate. Okay. So let's see here. Let me make sure. Let's take a look at the long footnote referenced by the phrase, since man and angel are alike under karmic law. So can we get a reader, please?
Ann P., can you read that for us, please?
Sorry, I was trying to unmute. Yes, I can.
There you go.
Explaining Kabbalistic views, the author of The New Aspects of Life says of the fallen angels that according to the symbolical teaching, spirit, from being simply a functionary agent of God, became volitional in its developed and developing action, and substituting its own will for the divine desire in its regard, so fell. Hence the kingdom and reign of spirits and spiritual action, which flow from and are the product of spirit volition, are outside and contrasted with and in contradiction to the kingdom of souls and divine action. So far, so good, but what does the author mean by saying, when man was created, he was human in constitution, with human affections, human hopes and aspirations. From this state he fell into the brute and savage. This is diametrically opposite to our Eastern teaching and even to the Kabbalistic notion so far as we understand it, and to the Bible itself. This looks like corporealism and substantialism coloring positive philosophy, though it is rather hard to feel quite sure of the author's meaning. A fall, however, from the natural into the supernatural and the animal. Supernatural meaning the purely spiritual in this case, means what we suggest.
Okay, so we're only going to take the first part of this. I don't want to get into her, the argument she has with this book described in the last part. So first up, explaining Kabbalistic views, the author of The New Aspects of Life says of the fallen angels that, according to the symbolical teaching, spirit, from being simply a functionary agent of God, became volitional in its developed and developing action, and substituting its own will for the divine desire in its regard, so fell. So here's the title page verse of Henry Pratt's New Aspect of Life and Religion, which HPB is here citing, published during the time that she was writing The Secret Doctrine. The quote seems to confirm the idea that there is or was a group of asuras who, through their own volition, chose to defy the high but impersonal directive that compelled the lesser devas to build the lower human vehicles. The idea of spirit choosing a path that goes against the will of God presents really an unfathomable paradox. After all, isn't God the ultimate expression of spirit? And if so, wouldn't the plan that is a part of the divine will include the high purpose of those asuras who refuse to incarnate? Considering this leads me to believe that the divine will, as here described, is simply that which initiates and then compels compliance with the involutionary phase of any natural cycle. And this is, of course, going to be under the purview of some great compelling being, quote unquote, God, right? But this isn't the God that is the absolute of all existence. This is the God, you could call it the third logos of this solar system in an evolutionary cycle that would, who energetically would compel the involutional, would compel those devas who were part of building and the involutionary cycle to do so. And that nonetheless, resisting that impulse was actually an important aspect of building the higher vehicles for humankind. It's a fascinating idea, really. Okay, let's continue with the quote from New Aspects of Life. Hence, the kingdom and reign of spirits and spiritual action, which flow from and are the product of spirit volition, are outside and contrasted with and in contradiction to the kingdom of souls and divine action. You know, this is a logical conclusion to an extraordinary teaching suggesting that the will to be, the compelling involutional force of the logos, resulting in the quote, kingdom of souls and divine action, swept into activity both this kingdom of souls and the lesser builders, but was resisted by the higher classes of asuras, called here the kingdom and reign of spirits and spiritual action. And that's where the two sides to this war in heaven, the suras and asuras. In order, as before mentioned, that they might build the higher human principles on cosmic etheric levels. Any thoughts or questions? We're going to skip the rest of this paragraph. Okay. Back to the text. Could we get a reader, please?
Gordon, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. When the dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. The Kabbalistic version of the same story is given in the Codex Nazarius, Scripture of the Nazarenes, and the real mystic Christians of John the Baptist and the initiates of Christos. Bahagzivo, father of the Vinayi, is ordered to construct creatures to create. But as he is ignorant of Orcus, he fails to do so and calls in Pedahil, a still purer spirit, to his aid, who fails still worse. This is a repetition of the failure of the fathers, the lords of light, who fail one after another.
Okay, thank you. So first, a quote from Revelations 12:7. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. Okay, this verse, which by the way is the only mention of a war in heaven in the entire Bible, and which is 180 degrees reversal of the true teaching, was promulgated by the church fathers, probably in order to usurp the earlier, more profound and more correct teachings of the Gnostics and other teachings of that period. In this verse from Revelations, we are told that Samael, or Satan, who is in truth a being from the higher darkness, the source of light, is in fact the devil of the lower darkness. Can we get a reader, please?
Janet, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. Originally, however, both Michael and Samuel were as one, both proceeding from the Ruah, soul, Neshama, spirit, and Nefesh, vitality. As taught in the Kabbalah in the Pleiadian Book of Numbers, Samuel is the concealed occult wisdom and Michael, the higher terrestrial wisdom, both emanating from the same source, but diverging after their issue from the mundane soul, which on earth is Mahat, intellectual understanding, or Manas, the seat of intellect. They diverge because one Michael is influenced by Neshama, while the other Samuel remains uninfluenced. This tenet was perverted by the dogmatic spirit of the church, which made of Samuel Satan, the most wise and spiritual spirit of all, the adversary of the atropomorphic God, anthropomorphic God, and sensual physical man, the devil.
Yeah, so this, you know, the same teaching, but she reveals a little more about the two adversaries, Samael and Michael. This quote, I think, is especially interesting. Samael is the concealed occult wisdom, and Michael, the higher terrestrial wisdom, both emanating from the same source, but diverging after their issue from the mundane soul, which on earth is Mahat. So I think there's a deeper understanding given in this description. Okay, we have the same fall from highest to lowest in the Egyptian Typhon, who was originally associated with the Great Bear, and thus with pure first-ray source spirit. But as the eons passed, came to represent in the later kingdoms of Egypt, came to represent the lower rather than the higher darkness. Okay. Next. The Kabbalistic version of the same story is given in the Codex Nazareus, the scriptures of the Nazarenes, the real mystic Christians of John the Baptist and the initiates of Christos. So here is the cited Codex Nazareus in the original Aramaic with a Latin translation. G.R.S. Meade and others have translated sections of the manuscript into English, but amazingly, no complete English edition has yet been created. I did a web search. I couldn't find any English translations of this that exist as yet. So, you know, if you need a project, there's a good one. Of course, you'll need to know Aramaic and Latin pretty well, you know. Okay, before we dive into this material, let's get a reader for this passage from the Secret Doctrine Dialogues. Reader, please.
Marianne, can you read for us, please?
Yes, I can. Mr. B. Knight, Keeglitly, you speak a good deal about various Gnostic systems. There are one or two points that wanted clearing up a little, referencing page 184 of SG1. If Theta Hill, as started later, represents the host of the Lunar Pitris, who created a senseless man, and if he is a still purer spirit than Bahak Sivu, what does the letter correspond to? Madame Blavatsky, the Nazarene business is not at all plain and is full of metaphor, chiefly directed against the God of the Jews and their opponents. Therefore, it is so mixed up that nobody will know which is which. He represented sometimes as a higher spirit and sometimes as a lower. Bahak Sivu corresponds sometimes to Christ and sometimes to other things. I have been bringing this in, not at all that you should come and ask me to learn it, because everyone can go and read it in the original who reads Latin. But why I have quoted it here is to show that in every system, high or low, the secret doctrine was repeated and there were things which were all based on truth. But you need not go out of your way to make me teach you the Nazarene system.
Thank you, Marianne. So this is a bit of a preamble to what's coming, which is this section on that explores Gnosticism. However, probably because she was overshadowed by these higher teachers, higher sources, masters of wisdom, etc., the actual text does make sense, even though it took some excavating to figure out. So next, the quote from the Codex Nazareus. Bahak Sivu, the father of the genie, is ordered to construct creatures to create. But as he is ignorant of Orcus, the deepest chaos of matter, he fails to do so and calls in Fetahil, a still purer spirit, to his aid, who fails still worse. This is a repetition of the failure of the fathers, the lords of light, who fail one after the other. So with this quote, HPB begins an extended teaching on Gnosticism, her purpose being to reveal the universality of the esoteric creation story as found in, for example, the wars of the Titans and the Puranas, the Suras and Asuras of the Zohar, and Michael and Samael of Christianity. So, genie is the Gnostic term for angel or deva. So, Bahak Sivu's position as father of the genie suggests that he is a great Mahadeva or archangel who, just like in the Theosophical story, was compelled to create. But instead of refusing, as in other traditions, he's simply unable to do so. In both cases, the meaning is essentially the same. The spiritual purity of such beings prevents them from forming the lower planes until the intervening planes that separate the higher and lower regions are activated. This is what is meant by being ignorant of Orcus, representing the chaos of the material realm. Before continuing, let's take a look at a passage. This is going to help explain this passage on Fedahil from the Theosophical Glossary. Give us a little more background on this Gnostic way. Could we get a reader, please?
Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
Okay. Fedahil, Tahil Gnostic, with the Nazarene Gnostics, the builder of the material worlds. In the Codex Nazareus, Abatur, the father, opens a gate and walks to the dark water, chaos, and looks down into it. The darkness reflects the image whereon a sun appears or is emanated. Logos or demiurge, Fedahil. Because Fedahil is thus produced in order to bring forth the worlds of manifestation, the Codex describes him as being immersed in the abyss of primordial stuff or matter, chaos.
Soliloquizing.
Thank you. On his inability alone to produce it. Whereupon Spiritus, the Gnostic mother, appears and unites with Karabtanos, cosmic Kama, involved in primordial matter, thus bringing forth seven stellars. These are, however, seven imperfect figures, which represent also the seven capital sins, the progeny of an astral soul separated from its divine source, spirit, and matter, the blind demon of concupiscence. Thank you. Seeing this, Fedahil extends his hand towards the abyss of matter and says, let the earth exist just as the abode of the powers has existed. Dipping his hand in the chaos, which he condenses, he creates a planet. The first Gnostic Trinity, equivalent to Father, Mother, Son, is composed of Pharaoh, Chaos, and Fedahil. This first triad is concealed or non-manifest, a pure abstraction to us. In the Codex Nazareus, Fedahil is also presented as one of the creative powers who were commanded to form man and who tried to obey, but failed because he was too pure, whereupon other and lower powers, Lunkabar Zivo, had to be called to complete the work. In the hierarchical. Thank you, structure of the universe. Also called creative powers of too high a rank are unable because of their spiritual purity and lofty state to form the lower planes until the intermediate ranges in the gradually descending ladder of life, having been evolved or emanated into manifestation.
You know, so here, thank you. So here we get a much more philosophical and scientific view of this idea of quote unquote refusing to create, much more likely that these are not emotionally based beings who would refuse a divine order. You know, these are high Mahadevas who are just simply whose essence is such that they cannot emanate into the lower planes. And so a great metaphor of the war in heaven was created in order to tell the quote unquote, tell the story, right? Okay. Here's a simplification of the Gnostic. Somebody's got their mic live. Of the Gnostic hierarchy of Logoi, listing Pharaoh as the first logos or life aspect, Mano as the second, and Abatur as the third logos. Fedahil is an emanation from the third logos, from Abatur, brought into being for the sole purpose of creating the lower quaternary, which he is unable to do without the help of Spiritus, the feminine aspect. In this illustration, we see the three logoi in the upper part, with Fetahil here identified with Mercury. Representing the dividing line between the higher and lower worlds, you know, another use of the meaning of the messenger of the gods, right? Spiritus, the Gnostic mother, is shown at lower right. In other Gnostic sects, the position of Fetahil was taken by Ialdabaoth, whose symbol was a lion-headed serpent. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Catherine, can you read that?
I think so. Okay. Starting with Thin Steps.
Always in the middle. We now quote from our earlier book.
We will now quote from our earlier volumes. Thin Steps on the Stage of Creation, the Spirit of the earth, so-called, or the soul, psyche, which St. James calls devilish, the lower portion, the anima mundi, or astral light. See the close of this sloka. With the Nazarenes and the Gnostics, this spirit was feminine. Thus the spirit of the earth, perceiving that for Fetahil, the newest man, the latest, the splendor was, quote, changed, and that for splendor existed decrease and damage. She awakes Charybdinos, who was frantic and without sense and judgment, and says to him, arise, see the splendor, light of the newest man, Fetahil, has failed to produce or create men. The decrease of this splendor is visible. Rise up, come with thy mother, the spiritus, and free thee from limits by which thou art held, and those more ample than the whole world.
Thank you. Okay, first up, then steps on the stage of creation, the spirit of the earth, so-called, or the soul, psyche, which St. James calls devilish, the lower portion, the anima mundi, or astral light. With the Nazarenes and the Gnostics, this spirit was feminine. So before we analyze the sentence, let's take a look at the footnote, which references the phrase, then steps onto the stage of creation, the spirit of the earth. The footnote reads, on the authority of Irenaeus, or of Justin Martyr, and the Codex itself, meaning the Codex Nazareus, Dunlop shows that the Nazarenes regarded spirit as a female and evil power in connection with our earth. Evil only because belonging to the lower regions of the astral light. The exoteric doctrine, which casts the female aspect as an evil power, has been one of the ancient sources of misogyny. Theosophy shuns this bias, defining the feminine creative powers as responsible for the form aspect. But the form aspect includes light, color, sound, and the creative word. Ultimately, it's the entire cosmic physical plane, save perhaps the highest subplane of the cosmic physical. The latter being personified by the goddesses, talking about the sound, the word, creative word here, by the goddesses Vash in Hinduism and Kuan Yin in China. So it's a bias that where the metaphor has worked its way into doctrine and then has become a prejudice. That's really has affected all societies. It's worth noting that Hinduism expresses no negative bias towards the form aspect, instead showing Shiva and Shakti, representing spirit and form, lovingly engaged. DK refers to the planetary spirit, also called the lower portion of the anima mundi, as the planetary elemental, which he tells us is, quote, a composite manifestation of the physical elementals of all manifested nature. In our studies and secret teachings of all ages, we've learned that the ancients recognized this feminine creative power as some form of Isis in Ishtar in Babylonia, and Athena in Greece. In modern parlance, she is Gaia or Mother Earth. In the context of this secret doctrine text, she is, quote, Spiritus, the Gnostic mother. The horizontal wand held here by Spiritus represents the diameter of the circle, which in relation to the formless realm symbolized by the circle itself, implements manifestation. Any thoughts or questions? One of the great things about the Gnostic form is that it wasn't perverted as the Christian form was. The story of the three Logoi and Fedahil and Spiritus, etc., describes correctly the nature of the Asura and the Suras, the formless ones and the form side. That's why I think HBB is using this and going into it so extensively. Okay, next. Thus, the spirit of the earth, perceiving that for Fedahil, the newest man, the latest, the splendor was changed, and that for splendor existed decrease and damage. Because she perceived that, she awakes Charybdis, who is frantic and without sense and judgment. So before we analyze this, let's take a look at the footnote, which references the name Fedahil. Can we get a reader, please?
Tom, can you read that for us, please? Tom, there you go.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Fedahil is identical with the host of the Pitris who created man as only a shell. He was with the Nazarenes, a king of light and the creator, but in this instance he is the unlucky Prometheus who fails to get hold of the living fire necessary for the formation of the divine soul, as he is ignorant of the secret name, the ineffable or incommunicable name of Kabbalists.
Thanks, Tom. So this references a similar event here described as a failure that takes place when the Dhyanis of the early root races project an etheric, incorporeal, but as yet unensouled humankind from themselves. In truth, this projection of the Chahaya is not a failure, but rather a stage, the first stage, in the formation of the lower vehicles of the human kingdom that took place during the first to the third root races, and is a necessary precedent for the later stage of ensoulment. The footnote on Charybdis simply states, the spirit of matter and concupiscence, Kamarupa minus manas or mind. So Charybdis is the spirit of blind or animal desire. He is the son of the Gnostic Spiritus, which is the astral light or the lower aspect of the Akasha, and is thus the generator in conjunction with this astral light of the lower quaternary. But as the footnote said, he is without the monastic principle, which in Theosophy is later provided by the Manasaputras in the middle of the third root race. Next, she says to him, arise, see the splendor, light of the newest man, Fedahil, has failed to produce or create man. The decrease of this splendor is visible. rise up, come with thy mother, the Spiritus, and free thee from limits by which thou art held, and those more ample than the whole world. A really convoluted passage. So the term newest man applied to Fetahil suggests the Manu, who appears at the beginning of a new cycle. Fetahil's splendor is decreased, much like the light of the moon decreases the light of the stars, because his spiritual purity prevents him from being able to project noumenal man into the lower quaternary. The quote, limits by which thou art held, talking to Charybdanos, also references this inability. So without the guiding influence of Fetahil, Charybdanos and Spiritus combine to create the lower substantive realms. But in doing so, the higher regions are shut out. The whole consciousness aspect shifts downward. It's an exact mirror of the Theosophical story. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Mary, can you read that for us, please? I lost you. Okay. Nadelle, can you read that for us, please? There we go.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
After which follows the union of the frantic and blind matter, guided by the insinuations of the spirit, not the divine breath, but the astral spirit, which by double essence is already tainted with matter. And the offer of the mother being accepted, the Spiritus conceived seven figures and the seven stellar planets, which represent also the seven capital sins, the progeny of an astral soul separated from its divine source, spirit and matter, the blind demon of concupiscence. Seeing this, Fetahil extends his hand towards the abyss of matter and says, let the earth exist, just as the abode of the powers has existed, dipping his hand in the chaos, which he condenses, he creates our planet.
So you can see the Genesis reference here in Fetahil, right? This relatively low god, actually emanated from the third logos, is the god of Genesis, right? First step. After which follows the union of the frantic and blind matter, guided by the insinuations of the spirit, not the divine breath, but the astral spirit, which by its double essence is already tainted with matter. Okay, the term frantic suggests the lower astral plane. Blind matter is the realm of Charybdanos, blind because devoid of manas. Their union suggests emerging of the astral and physical planes, all the while emphasizing the tainted aspect inherent in matter. Guided by insinuations of the spirit suggests the impetus of the Gnostic mother aspect, Spiritus, right? Which derives its life from the breath of Akasha rather than from the breath of the Logos. A more neutrally presented version of this same descent into matter is beautifully summarized in verse 9 of stanza 3 in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. Quote, light is cold flame, and flame is fire, and fire produces heat, which yields water, the water of life in the Great Mother. Okay, next. The offer of the mother being accepted, the Spiritus conceives seven figures, and the seven stellars, planets, which represent also the seven capital sins. So the seven figures, also called stellars, correspond to the seven lower eons, which are the planetary elementals of the seven planets known to the ancients. This realm of the lower quaternary creates an environment where seven capital sins can and will be committed. Possibly these seven sins represent the shadow side of the seven rays when distorted by the influence of the lower quaternary. It's important to note that nowhere in the Codex Nazareus does it say that Spiritus created the seven capital sins. Rather, she, in concert with Charybdanos, created the mental, astral, and physical environment wherein sin, or more correctly, error, eventually manifests, because these lower regions, as shown by these wavy lines, is cut off from the source of life itself. At any rate, these seven sins are definitely, quote, the progeny of an astral soul separated from its divine source, spirit, and matter, the blind demon of concupiscence. Concupiscence, or concupiscence, I like piscence better, generally means strong sexual desire, but in this context suggests any and all passion born of the astral plane, astral realm. Finally, seeing this, Fetahil extends his hand towards the abyss of matter and says, let the earth exist, just as the abode of the powers has existed. Dipping his hand in the chaos, which he condenses, he creates our planet. This passage definitely identifies Fetahil as a function of the Gnostic Abatur, who is Brahma, the third logos. And as I said, also with God of Genesis, or Jehovah, also called the Aldabaoth, who's actually an emanation from Spiritus, Fetahil is considered an even higher form than the God of the Christians. Okay, next step, could we get a reader, please?
Yes, and Veronica, can you read that for us, please? And Veronica, can you read that for us, please? Okay, that isn't working. Barbara, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. Then the Codex proceeds to tell how Bahaxivo was separated from the Spiritus and the genii, or angels, from the rebels. Then Manoth, the greatest, who dwells with the greatest, Zerho, called Zibar Zivo, known also by the name of Nebat Lavar Bar Ayufin Ifafin. I'm sorry, I'm fracturing that.
You got a hard reading here.
Helm and vine of the food of life, he being the third life and commiserating the rebellious and foolish genii on account of the magnitude of their ambition, says Lord of the Genii, eons, see what the genii, the rebellious angels, do and about what they are consulting. They say, quote, let us call for the world and let us call the powers into existence, end quote. The genii are the principles, the sons of light, but thou art the messenger of light.
Thank you. Okay, first, then the Codex proceeds to tell how Bahaxivo was separated from the Spiritus and the genii, or angels, from the rebels. Okay, Bahaxivo was the father of the genies, or devas, who was ordered to create physical creatures but couldn't because he was too highly placed in the hierarchy of beings to do so. After the feminine spiritus, in union with corruptados, created the lower realms, Bahaxivo, as well as Fedahil, were separated from the mother aspect. This is the Gnostic version of the story of the separation of those Dianis who refused or unable to create from the angels, here described as genii, devas of a lower class who worked with the creative forces. In the Codex, Bahaxivo is associated with the great architect, suggesting that he was able to design the lower regions as well as the human form, but not able to physically create them. Next, then Manu, the greatest, who dwells with the greatest Firho, called Kibar Zivo, known also by the name of Nebat Lavar Bar Yufin Afafin. So here we have two new characters introduced, Pharaoh and Manu, representing the first and second logoi, or eons, in Gnosticism. Pharaoh represents the abstract father principle, like the first logos of theosophy. Manu, the sun, or Christ principle, the supreme source of light and the chief form of expression in this solar system, a kind of cosmic Christ, second logos kind of position. In Gnosticism, an eon is a spiritual being and or a sphere of existence that has emanated from that spiritual being. Theosophy has a similar doctrine in the idea that the planes and subplanes are themselves great beings. We learned this in a treatise on cosmic fire, that the planes themselves are great beings who have names, such as Varuna for the astral plane. Manu emanates the lower five eons and is himself an emanation of the, quote, unknown formless life known as Pharaoh. Lord Pharaoh emanates the highest two eons. Together, Manu and Pharaoh make up the primordial seven, which, when applied to humankind, characterize its seven principles. Five material and semi-material emanated from Manu, and the higher two immaterial and spiritual principles emanated from Lord Pharaoh. The footnote on Manu reads, "This Manu of the Nazarenes strangely resembles the Hindu Manu, the heavenly man of the Rig Vedas." So in Hinduism, the Manu appears at the beginning of manifestation and represents that from which everything, all humanity that is derived. Similarly, in theosophy, the Manu is the primordial or primal progenitor of a given human root race. But though Manu shares some of the initiating characteristics of the Manu, in Gnosticism, Manu represents the Christ principle, the second aspect of deity, whereas the Manu is the office holder of the first aspect, and is thus, to my mind, more equivalent to Bahaxivo. Kibar Zivo, another name for Lord Pharaoh, is described in Codex Nazareus as the creator and ruler of the higher or spiritual aspects of the seven planets and the seven heavens. Nebat Lavar Bar Lufin Ifafin is the Arabic name for this high, the same high logos. You know, first thing you have to learn is not to let these names throw you. Just look through them, try to find the meaning that is there in spite of all these names. Next up, then Manu, helm and vine of the food of life, he being the third life and commiserating the rebellious and foolish genie, on account of the magnitude of their ambition, says, "Lord of the genie, eons. See what the genie, the rebellious angels, do, and about what they are consulting. They say, let us call for the world, and let us call the powers into existence. So the rebellious, foolish, overambitious genie refers to the futile efforts of Bahak Zivo and Fetahil to create on the dense physical plane, a fact pointed out in what appears to be a conversation between the first and second Logoi, Mano and Pharaoh, wherein Mano almost seems to be mocking the efforts of the genies. Look at these fools trying to create the earth. They can't do that, right? The phrase helm and vine of the food of life suggests the Christian idea of the body and blood of Christ. The phrase he being the third life, talking about Mano here, refers to the fact that though Mano represents the second principle, he is the third to appear, being born of the father or Pharaoh, and the mother, not spiritus, but rather universal mind. I know it's complicated stuff, but once you get familiar with it, it's a fascinating hierarchy of both philosophical ideas and personas. The footnote referencing helm and vine of the food of life states, I am the true vine, and my father is the husbandman. Again, suggesting a parallel between Mano and the Christ. The footnote referencing Lord of the Genie, also called Eons, states, with the Gnostics, Christ, as well as Michael, who is identified with him in some respects, was the chief of the Eons. Supporting the connection drawn here, the Lord of the Genie can also be seen as a synonym for the Master of Angels, which is also a title of the Christ. But there are also differences between the two. For whereas the Christ represents the second aspect par excellence, as Archangel Michael embodies the third or intelligent activity aspect of deity. Finally, the genii are the principles, the sons of light, but thou art the messenger of life. Here the voice seems to shift to Lord Pharaoh, who refers to the devas or genies that make up the human principles, and then acknowledges Mano as the messenger of light. Okay, next up. Yes, I see a hand.
Please go ahead. Helios Old Voice, go ahead, please.
Are you muted? Unmuted? Somewhere?
She just muted herself again.
There you go. You're unmuted. There may be a mechanical button on your mic that you need to click. Sometimes.
How about now?
Yes.
All right. Thanks. It was a mechanical button.
Okay,
great. I have a question. Can we go back one slide? It pertains to the previous context. I heard and I looked at the orders of angels because it's available information everywhere. And some of the orders of angels are called powers and principles.
Right.
And what we just went over, somehow, strangely, those words in the text, let us call the powers into existence. It's a strange feeling that maybe they were calling the powers, the order of angels, in order to help or co-create. I don't know. I'm just making it up. But yeah, it strongly has that sense of they were probably asking the Father, hey, let's bring more power here, powers, order of angels and principles.
These are the, actually, let's go up to this slide back here a little bit. Oh boy, it's back here. Where was that?
It was in that text that, that right there. See, it says,
there's one. Oh, yes. Goodness. Here it is. This is what. Uh-huh. These archons are also called powers. These are the lower powers, not power like first ray power or the power of the spirit aspect. Mm-hmm. And the principles are these devic, or it's really archangels or Mahadevas.
They are higher than archangels.
Than the powers.
Yeah.
They're higher. Mm-hmm. They're higher. Yes, indeed. You know. So it's a different use of the terms, but it's consistent within this form, right? Where the powers, also called archons or archons of the abyss, right, represent these potencies. Like here, you can see down here, ether, fire, air, water, earth, which are considered lower powers, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. This is so much here. Is there any possibility to have like at least one webinar on that alone?
Yeah, well, this is it. This is that webinar. Here's what I'd recommend. You can get a lot from going to makara.us and downloading this webinar and re-listening to it with the slides and stopping at each phase along the way and until you really can assimilate what's being given here. And you know, that's my constant frustration in giving these, because you know, I spend a lot of time preparing for these. And so by the time I'm actually hosting them, you know, at least to some extent, I know what I'm talking about. And that's mainly because I put the time in and done the research. You know, there's no way that you can sort of instantly have that same level of comprehension unless for some reason you happen to be an expert on this particular field, whatever we're talking about, you know. So one way to really help with that is what I just said, which is to go to either Makara or YouTube and just listen, stop, and you know, read and consider what I say during the webinar, and back up when you need to until you get it. And that will, in and of itself, you know, help a lot. I mean, it would be terrific to create a whole series on Gnostic thought, but you know, we're sort of confined by the flow of the secret doctrine here and how it unfolds, you could say. And she gives quite a bit of time to this method, I think, because it was, you know, certainly relative to the Christian method, along with the Nazareus method, quite enlightened, you know, close a thing to theosophical thought extant in the world at that time. So
all this in the secret doctrine, I assume, right? This is
all. It is the secret doctrine.
Okay, base. This is all representation. By your research and your deep thought, and this is interpretation of the secret doctrine that Yelena Petrovna wrote, right?
Exactly. What you see on the right here is the actual pages of the secret doctrine.
Yes. There's a lot of footnotes, which are by themselves a lot of material research. Where do you go for those?
You know, I do it. Sometimes a footnote will take me 2 hours to try to figure out what and to try to find the references, etc. So what's in white here is printed here, right?
Yeah.
And then, so what you're getting in these webinar series is the secret doctrine, period, you know. And of course, you know, I try to, when I give my opinions, I tell you. Otherwise, it's research based on either the works of Alice Bailey or the works of HPB, other parts of HPB's works that support what I'm putting forward. So that's the way I work.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Francis, I also want to add that when we post the recordings to Makara, we post Francis's slides. He shares his slides with us. It's probably easier to watch on YouTube, but the slides aren't included on the YouTube version. So I would recommend that everybody go and download them first from Makara. Makara, and then watch the YouTube version. And also, Martha says that Wikipedia, if you look up the hierarchy of angels, it has some simple information on the nine choirs of angels that
nine stages of consciousness, yeah, represented by the angels. That's
sure. So that's all delineated there in Wikipedia.
Great. Okay. Good. I think we are out of time. So do you want to make announcements for the next webinars? Okay.
The next Secret Doctrine a month from now is on March 17th, St. Paddy's Day. But closer to us, the next Secret Teaching of All Ages will be the 3rd of March. And then the next Treatise on Cosmic Fire is going to be 8 March.
Yeah, the Cosmic Fire just happened to coincide with the first, which is on the second Sunday, was the time of the new moon and conflicted with a Tuya presentation. And then the one coming up, the fourth, which would have come up on the fourth Sunday, is conflicting with the full moon, which I will be presenting in, because Tuya will be traveling. And since, so the actual next, we just skip basically for the Treatise on Cosmic Fire the whole month of February. So that's it. So thank you all for coming, and we'll see you on, I guess the very next webinar is beside the full moon webinars, will be Secret Teachings of All Ages. Wow, that's the longest break I've had in years.
Put your feet up.
Oh, that's it. You know, with the conference coming, that's what
I'm doing. I know. I don't know how many presentations you have for the conference, but I'm working on my 3. So, And for those of you who don't know, who haven't heard yet, the Seven Ray Institute and the University of the Seven Rays, the conference is going to be a little later than usual. It's going to be May 21st through June 2nd. The Aquarian Christ, the coming avatar of love. And it centers around the Gemini full moon, the festival of the Christ. So let's put in a little plug for that.
Yay. Great. Yeah, you should, if you haven't been to a conference, you really should try it out. There's some absolutely fantastic presentations given in both the pre-conference, which is on rayology, and another one on astrology, and the main conference, which is a wide range of topics, but usually having to do with, you know, the title of the conference. So yeah, okay. Get involved.
Hold on a minute. Someone has asked before I close everything out here. Someone has asked for the information on the conference.
The website is the way to go with that.
The website is not updated yet. It still has the...
Oh, really? Oh, that's...
It still has the 2023, but I imagine they will be updating it very soon. And no, it will not be at Wesak. It's a month after the Wesak full moon. But for those of you who...
I could put a... I'm going out of share. I'm going to go over to my email. I can put a blurb that was sent in email in the chat box.
Okay, I've put it in the, I've put the Seven Ray Org in there, and it has the 38th conference, the Aquarian Christ, the coming avatar of love, and it has the dates there on the home page. But when you click on the conference, it still has the 2023 info. So stick to the home page, and then there are there is an announcement out if you sign up for posts from us. You know, you can specify that you want to know about the conference stuff.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, there it is. Yeah. Did you put share screen on?
No, I didn't put share screen on. I just
hang on. Let me do that, and you can see what she's talking about. One second here. Get back to Zoom. Share screen. Here's your whole screen. There we go. Oops. Why are you doing this?
And soon they'll have the information, and then soon they'll have the how to register.
Okay, so here we go. Here's, you should be able to see this on the screen.
Yes, we can.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And it says, yeah, it gives a little blurb about it, but yeah, nothing's up yet. But you can find out some basic information.
That front page gives the dates. It starts with a 2-day ceremonial workshop, and then there's then I think will be
the seven
moon, the Gemini, this Gemini right. Full moon, and then will be the esoteric astrology pre-conference, and then will be the seven ray pre-conference, and then the main conference will start on Wednesday,
right,
like the 27th of
May. You know, watch this space. That's the bottom line here, because information will go up soon. And the address, just do sevenray.org.
Okay. If you actually click, okay, if you go back to that home page, there's under the dates, there's a about the conference, and if you click on that, it gives you a little bit more info.
Anyway, you'll be able to get more as, I don't know when this is going to go up, but I think it's getting close to time. That you'll get a whole bunch about the conference, bios, etc., of the presenters and all the subject matter. So, okay, you all.
Okay.
Thanks much. See you
Thank
next
you, time. Everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.